Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or jeffweilercolumbusautomall.com.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Hi, I'm Margie Nomura, and welcome to the Desert Island Dishes podcast. This is the podcast where every week I ask my guests to choose their 7 Desert Island dishes. These range from finding out about the dish that most reminds them of their childhood, the best dish they've ever eaten, and of course, the last dish they would choose to eat before being cast off to the desert island. The question is, what would you choose as your last meal? Hi, how are you all? Do you know, the most amazing thing about this job is really the people that I get to meet and talk to. I've admired Asma and her work for many years now. I absolutely loved her episode of Chef's Table on Netflix. I highly recommend it if you haven't seen it yet. So it really was a pleasure to sit down with her and hear her story firsthand. The work she does is truly amazing, and it feels like she's only really just getting started. I really hope you enjoyed today's episode. My guest today is Asma Khan. Asma is an award-winning chef, best-selling cookbook writer, and owner of one of London's most loved Indian restaurants, the Darjeeling Express. Not only does she hold a PhD in British constitutional law and is an honorary fellow at Oxford University, she was the first British chef to feature on Netflix's famed show Chef's Table. She's written 3 cookbooks whilst running her restaurant with a kitchen staffed entirely by women. Time magazine named her one of 2024's 100 most influential people, and in 2019, Business Insider named her number one on their list of 100 coolest people in food and drink. While she found her love and passion of cooking perhaps later in life compared to some, Asma's tenacity and drive make her now one of the UK's most respected chefs. Her latest book, Monsoon, is out now. Welcome, Asma.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
In 2019, Business Insider named you number one on the 100 coolest people in food and drink. That's pretty cool. Like, how does that feel?
Oh my God. My first reaction was, oh my God, finally my kids are going to think I'm cool because someone else called me cool.
Number one.
Yeah, but it felt really good. And, you know, I was a bit embarrassed as well and grateful. Yeah, it felt great.
Do those accolades, do they mean a lot?
They mean a lot and they also don't mean anything. Mm. It's at 2 layers. They mean a lot because I then look at all the other people who I know probably working harder than me and are deserving of the accolade that I was given. So I feel very humbled at that level. Mm. But I also feel that, you know, I have a much bigger fish to fry. I'm always trying to think of how I can open more doors for other women, how I can make a difference, how I can get my story out. So in some ways, these things help because your voice reaches to a different audience. But personally, I don't take these things very seriously. Yeah. I don't take myself very seriously. I think of it more like a kind of opportunity to do some good and reach out to a great new audience.
when you were talking about the director of Netflix's Chef's Table, you said, she didn't ask me any pointless questions about my husband and marriage, and I didn't need to explain what my mother meant to me. She just got it. So, Asma, I'm going to try very hard to have that in my head and emulate her and not ask you any pointless questions. But we are going to dive straight into the first dessert.
Absolutely.
That's the dish that most reminds you of your childhood.
It's something called aloo chop. Aloo is potato. Chop is basically like a patty. But it's something that we ate more than 2-3 times a week. Mm. It's potatoes stuffed with mince. And the only thing that's used to spice the mince is salt and pepper. It's an Anglo-Indian dish. Mm. It's a British-influenced dish. And then, you know, the potato, you know, patty is dipped in crumb and then it's deep fried. And that I used to always love with ketchup. And that is my favorite dish. And finally, I have the recipe in Monsoon. And I love that Nigella Lawson picked that dish up because there is something very British about that dish. And, you know, Calcutta being the capital of the empire, in India. That influence, aloo chop, that's distinctive. So there are no masalas, no Indian spices in it. It's just salt and pepper. But that is my absolutely ultimate favorite childhood dish and my favorite dish even now.
So you'd have that several times a week?
Yeah, yeah. Also, I think that it's also inexpensive. In a family where, you know, you couldn't, you know, if you cut up a chicken into 8 pieces, you know, we always have our chicken jointed. Not everybody, not all the sizes of this joints are the same. Yeah. But aloo chop was always something that was inexpensive and filling, and kids loved it, and it was not spicy. So even very young kids could eat it.
One of the things that I thought was so fascinating about your childhood was that your parents were both from different regions and actually both from different royal families. You say them being from different regions was actually really rare, but it was something that's turned out to be the huge benefit to you because you have these two cultural influences. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's really to do with the staple, rice and wheat. Mm. Bengal is you know, Bay of Bengal. There's the Delta, so great for growing rice. My father comes from a very arid region, which is perfect for wheat. So my father doesn't eat rice and my mother doesn't eat roti.
Really?
So, yeah, because that's you ate what was, you know, local to you.
Yeah.
Things have changed a lot now, but when they were growing up, even when I was growing up, you ate what was local to you. I mean, no one kind of cling film wrapped and in a refrigerated lorry sent you food from outside.
Yeah.
Now, it's a different world. Let's not talk about now. I hate what's happening in India now. So my father would not eat rice and my mother would not eat roti. And it makes a huge impact on what is it that is being cooked. Mm-hmm. Because when there is roti, you do not have things that are got a lot of gravy in it or they're put into bowls. Even the dal is very thick. Whereas if you're eating rice, everything has got a lot of gravy in it. The dal is very watery because you eat with your hands and that rice is so absorbent, it sucks up all that gravy and juice. Totally different. And also weather is very different. We don't really have in Bengal a winter. I mean, winter literally kisses you and goes away. Yeah. Whereas in where my father grew up, there was like 3 months of really cold, different food, things that were very kind of laden with spice because you needed that heat. You never ate them in Bengal because, my God, you don't want more heat.
Yeah.
So really very different food cultures, completely different.
So how did that work together under one roof?
Well, luckily, my mother had a catering business. So we had more than your average number of cooks and chefs. We had a big kitchen, a commercial kitchen outside. So we used to have two kinds of cuisines. But that was a huge advantage because I got to try and taste two different styles of food. And I literally have picked and, you know, whatever I liked, and that's what I learned to cook.
Mm.
So I went back and learned to cook something from my father's region, something from my mother's region, which is unusual because the way arranged marriages work in India traditionally, especially, you know, the people getting married in the 60s and 50s, is that people got you married to someone from your own region.
Mm.
Because India is very different with language, with food, everything. So you married people who were like you. So you tended to eat the same food.
Yeah.
My father and mother, very different people, but were married off because they were both royal. So okay. No one really cared about the fact that my mother ate rice, my father, this is irrelevant.
Okay.
People were just, you know, the matchmaker was just trying to get this done. the wedding. Yeah. And so
they're both royal.
That was all they care about. But they were both royal, so that tick boxes. The fact that they would not eat the same food, it didn't matter.
You are the middle child. Yes. You have an older sister and a younger brother, and you say that your family lamented the birth of a second daughter instead of the desired son, and that there is a deafening silence in India about the disappointment a family feels at having the second daughter. I know that you're involved in this amazing charity even now, but is that a feeling that does still exist in India, or is it getting less?
I don't think it's getting less. But definitely, there is still dowry. Girl is seen as a financial liability. Yeah. You know, more and more people are obsessed about these grand, all singing, all dancing weddings.
Yeah.
Media is obsessed with these big celebrity weddings, which is with outrageous amount of money being spent. Everybody's aspiring to have a grand wedding for their daughter. It's seen as establishing your status. Yeah. Marriage and daughters and honor are all interlinked. The honor of the family is always linked to the girl, never the boy. And this is why the girl has all these restrictions put on them. And there is a financial cost. When you have a daughter, you know you've got to pay for the wedding, pay for the dowry, and you've got to protect her honor and get her married and hope that she doesn't fall in love with someone inappropriate and run off. So the societal pressure of conforming is still there. And today, in most families, the entire asset is inherited by the boy. So whether it's the farm or the family house, the family shop, the business, no one gives assets to the girl because she's the outsider now. She's married to someone else. You want to keep it within your family. And I remember this, that my neighbor loudly said that, you know, when you have daughters, it's as if you're watering your neighbor's garden because she's not going to stay in your garden. We are married off. There's no question of not getting you married. In fact, everybody would question you. You would have failed as parents if you did not get your daughter married off in this grand ceremonial kind of, you know, display of wealth and power. All of this works against us. So change cannot happen when society as a whole still embraces all these values. This is our biggest challenge, that your parents may be progressive, but society as a whole is still very conservative. Yeah. And they still have these norms. This is where we fall. I think that the big problem is when you have another girl, there is this panic and fear that what if we do not have a son? Yeah. What is going to happen to our bloodline? I've met some really interesting women who've said that when they had only girls, that their father was constantly taunted, that who's going to carry your family name? And I'm not going to name her. But she went on to become an extremely powerful politician.
Oh, wow.
And she told me that she came straight after seeing the Netflix thing. She was so emotional. She said, I'm an extremely powerful politician. I am recognized in this country. And today my father is called the father of, with my name.
Oh my goodness, that's giving me goosebumps.
This is what is happening. Mm. That there is still that lamenting that who will carry our name. The irony of it all is that, especially the second girls and, you know, the ones who feel and internalize the sense of being othered and not being wanted, we go on and set the world on fire. Our parents are then called, like, you are the parents of so-and-so, the girl. But still, when the asset is the boys and the surname is carried by the boy, the clan is always about the boy.
Yeah. You say an internalized feeling. Was that something that you were aware of as a child?
Yes, but the thing is interesting because I think after the initial disappointment that my mother was made to feel she had failed, not by my dad, but by her own mother who had five daughters. She kept telling her mother, you've got to make sure you don't have another daughter. And my mother did. So I think she found it very overwhelming and she was upset when I was born. But very soon after, I realized very quickly, they really loved me. I was made to feel very valued by my immediate family. Extended family, friends, society made me feel unwanted.
I'm so sorry.
No, but I think that all of us can relate to this who are girls in South Asia, but no one articulates it. I was very lucky that my parents didn't do it and that I had this great inner confidence because of the love I got especially the love from my sister and my brother. You know, they made me feel like I was a superstar. But what happens to girls, it's a lifelong wound that never heals. I carry the wounds. My wounds are not healed. And from this festering wound comes this fire to make a difference.
Yeah.
Never will these wounds heal. This is why it's unacceptable that we damage the lives of young children, young girls. We are damaging the lives of young children by making one child feel more valued than the other.
Yeah.
Take it from me, the wound never heals.
It's really scary how you obviously had an onslaught of these kind of comments. But I often think in everybody's life, there is a moment where you get a comment from a stranger or a family member, and it's often not a parent, and you have no control over what it is that's said to you. But those things do stay with you forever, and they can happen at any moment.
And now, I mean, the social media and the exposure to people who are not kind, and how many young lives are being damaged by trolling on social media? I wish people would understand this.
We're going to pause there in a very unnatural segue and talk about the first dish that you learned to cook.
The first dish was something very easy. It's zeera aloo. Zeera is whole cumin seeds and potatoes. And I understood that you can't mess this up because you boil the potatoes. You boil the potatoes and then all you do is that you infuse the kind of the cumin and dried chilies, put a bit of turmeric if you want, or salt. You can't go wrong because it's not that it can be raw, it cannot burn. And that was the first dish I made and it was so nice and I was so proud of myself. I still make it a lot. In fact, the first dish I taught my son when he was going to uni. I said, learn to make this. I'm from Bengal. We are big in potatoes. We love potatoes. And then I told him, you can start adding other stuff to it. But learn to make this potato as a base, you know, and you'll be fine. So that's the first thing I learned to cook.
How old do you think you were?
22.
Oh, yeah?
I didn't know how to cook till I came to this country.
Because I was going to ask, so you got married at the age of 21
yeah.
in an arranged marriage. Yeah. And that was something that you knew all about, but it was kind of sprung on your husband, I think. Is that right?
Yeah, my husband didn't know he was coming into an arranged marriage. He thought he was meeting a journalist who was going to help him with an interview.
Oh, my goodness, really?
His family lied to him. My family told me that this boy is coming and we want you to meet. And if you like him, you know, let me know. You know, we can get you married. So, you know, arranged marriages are not forced marriages. It's like, you know, speed dating, but with your entire family involved.
Okay.
Yeah. So if you have to make a decision quite soon. You can't have choices of going out and seeing this person and dating. All of that doesn't
matter. First impressions.
Yeah, yeah. It's first impressions and you don't have, you know, you don't go out on dates. I mean, nowadays I know people too. Met my husband. We went out for a couple of meals. We saw each other for a few days and then... I explained to him that this is arranged marriage. He was appalled. And then I told him that, you know, you're going to regret this so much. You're going to walk away from like the greatest person you could ever be married to.
I love that energy.
And I think that shocked him. The next day he came and said, yeah, let's get married. So yeah, I can sell anything to anyone. Because this man who was like, oh my God, this is such a bad idea. It's appalling. And how could everyone do to me? He was quite outraged that he was put into this position. I've never asked him why he said yes.
You've never asked?
No, why? I don't want to know. I don't know. So then the next question is, did you regret that? No way. Never, ever go into a conversation where you know you may not like the answer.
That's true. Yeah. That's good.
No, I am very smart. No. So I never asked my husband why he agreed to marrying me.
I think he'd say only good things.
I'm not so sure about that. That's why I never ask him.
Maybe not after 30 years, but yeah. You could have asked him a while ago.
Yeah.
So soon after you got married, you moved with him to Cambridge.
Yeah.
And one of the things I found you said about that time was that you didn't really know how to cook. And so whilst you're waiting for your university course, you actually traveled home several times and taught yourself to cook.
Yes, yes. And even though I didn't know how to cook, I spent a lot of my childhood in the kitchen watching everybody else cook. When my mother had a catering business.
Yeah.
It's the greatest way to learn to cook because I was immersed in this... in the aromas, the sounds, you know, the mustard seeds popping, the dried chilies, you know, that smokiness. I knew when the onions were ready because I would see them scrambling to get the caramelized onions out. So with the aromas and, you know, so I learned not from looking at a piece of paper or watching a video. I learned by being in that space. Once something was safe to try, she would get the cooks to give it to me to taste for seasoning, for flavor, and if I said that, oh, it needs a bit more lemon or it needs some chilies or salt, She never tasted it again because I had a really good palate and I understood what the food was. This is why within like, you know, a few weeks, I learned to cook everything I wanted because I understood that tweaking. I understood the layering. I understood the stages that you cook.
Mm-hmm. Well, they do say the first thing you should do when you're learning to cook is really learn to eat.
Yes.
Because if you don't do that first, you can never understand how to
cook. It's so important. And, you know, if you have a child who only likes to eat and is not interested in cooking, just wait.
Yeah.
Be patient because then they'll become like me.
Yeah.
I only ate. I would absolutely not do anything and not go in the kitchen and help at all. I could recreate all of this because I ate it and I loved it.
Mm. You say of that time in Cambridge when you first got to England, you were quite lonely.
Yeah.
And one of the impetuses for learning how to cook was so that you could make friends, which I think's so important to remember the power of food and the power of cooking.
Yes, food is a language of love. Mm. And I realized when I didn't know how to cook, how isolated, vulnerable, and incredibly marginalized I felt from everything. And then when I learned to cook and I came back, my world changed. Through cooking, I went home.
Mm.
Emotionally, I felt rooted. I felt connected. It made me a sense of being complete. Because before that, I felt hollow and inadequate and unwanted and all the time anxious that, you know, what am I doing here? I don't fit in. But then once the little flat in Cambridge was infused with the aromas of cumin and dried chilies and saffron, I had gone home.
Oh, you have such a beautiful way of describing things. I feel like I'm instantly transported. We're going to talk about the third desert island dish. What was the best dish you've ever eaten?
It's something we make in weddings. I have to say one thing.
Yeah.
On my own wedding, it was made and they didn't give it to me.
Oh, what?
I'm still upset with everybody. They did not feed me because I was dressed. Because in our bride, you know, we wear, you know, I'm from a royal family. So we wear jewelry from, you know, from the head to the toe. And, you know, it's you also wear this kind of ring around, you know. They told me, oh, no, it's going to make a mess. I don't care. I wanted to eat. And what upset me is everybody kept telling me, you're very stressed out. It's going to be fine. You look great. I said, no, I want to eat. No one fed me. But in our weddings, we make something called kusi.
It's good you don't hold a grudge.
No, I told all my cousins, I'm going to get married again. You're going to make this dish and you guys are going to come and feed me. And I swear I will do it one day.
You need to renew your vows.
I think, yeah, I'll still marry the same guy.
Yeah.
But I want to have that. So there's something called kusi. It's an Iraqi dish. But because my family has connections to the Middle East, it's an entire goat that's cooked on coal and wood, stuffed with chicken. And inside the chicken is rice and inside the rice is egg.
Oh, wow.
And it is sublime. And it's not in all our weddings. It's mostly boys' weddings that you have that. But in my wedding, it was supposedly there. Everyone said it was the best they've ever eaten.
Of course.
I never got to eat it. But that is a unique dish to my family.
Wow.
It's just unbelievable. Layered with spices, but not with a lot of chilies. This is the Iraqi thing, you know, because it's not super spicy. And, oh my God, the aroma when it isn't being cooked. I was sitting as a bride, sitting upstairs saying, whoa, that's going to be great. And they never gave it to me. But in other people's weddings, I didn't like getting dressed up, but I would always go to a wedding to eat that.
Okay, because I was going to say, so how many times in your life do you think you've eaten that?
Maybe 5-6 times. Okay. So it's not like a lot.
Yeah, which but makes it even more special.
Yeah, it's very distinctive to my family. I don't know what it is like in Iraq. I haven't eaten this in Iraq, but it is an Iraqi dish.
Mm.
But it was created in my family, recreated for weddings, only made in weddings. And it's amazing.
So you ended up moving from Cambridge to London, where you studied at King's College and you got a PhD. And after that, it was when you started doing the supper clubs and you did it from home. And I think to begin with, it was 12 people. What was the driving force behind that?
I realized towards the end of my PhD that I did not want to teach and I did not want to practice. But it wasn't that I didn't want to do law. I really wanted to cook.
Mm.
But this is 2010. Where did you see anyone like me? Not in food media, not in the restaurant business, not in hospitality. An outsider in her 40s, an accented Muslim immigrant setting up a restaurant. And so I wanted to do food. And this is why I began in my own house. In fact, I set it up the day I finished my PhD Viva. Usually in your Viva, they don't tell you, but because I was so ready to pass out and cry, and I looked like I was going to faint with fear, they very kindly told me, oh, you passed. I finished it, but I was now ready to switch my path.
Mm.
And there was going to be food. I didn't know how. I didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't have anyone who I could look to. I didn't have anyone whose advice I could take. I thought, I'm going to be fine. I love this. It's my passion. I'm good at it. And, you know, I'm going to leave it to God, you know. And my faith is a very important part of who I am. And I thought, you know, this is my decision. And, you know, even I'm alone and if I fail, at least I tried.
Mm.
And that's how I began.
Did you feel as soon as you started doing it that you had really found your sense of purpose? Was it an instant feeling?
This I don't remember. The first few supper clubs, in fact, almost 10 or 12, I kept no money. It was for hunger charities. Because I lacked confidence. Mm. I felt people will come, they'll hate my house, they'll hate my food, they'll hate me. So if then all the money, entire money, is going to the charity, I would always invite them as well. Mm. So they could talk about their charity. I felt that, you know, let me start in an auspicious way. In our culture, you know, from the East, you bring good luck and you bring good tidings to anything if you look after someone who's not had such an easy time in life. And so the entire money was going to hunger charities, was going for nutrition of women. And in some ways, I began that way. And then people were like, you know, oh, I want to bring my partner, I want to bring my friend. And I thought, oh, wow, they really love it. But, you know, I may radiate confidence right now.
Mm.
This is not how it started. So please don't look at me now and think, oh, wow, you know, I don't have that kind of confidence. I was really without confidence. Please do not allow that to stop you from dreaming. My dream was big. I started small. I started in my own house.
What was the dream?
The dream was to use food as a way of talking about justice and equality and the role that women played. Because what I could see is, and I knew this from my lived experience, that in every home, it was women cooking. Mm. When my kids were going to school, all the dinner ladies were women, you know, many of them grandmothers. There was this feminine energy with food. But when you went and saw food media and you saw who was cooking, it had morphed into this macho, combat, mortal kind of, you know, testosterone-driven combat sport. This men were almost trying to make this so physical and so testosterone-driven and so physical as if to wipe out that food has always been about women.
Mm.
We are the nourishers, we are the healers, not just in the East, in the West. The power of women to cook and heal is in every culture. Yet, the power to make money and to be seen as professional was taken over by men who were doing a good job, but they excluded us by presenting hospitality and professional cooking as something that was so alien to so many of us. We were not welcome. And I thought, not only am I going to shatter that door, I'm going to bring the edifice down so that every woman who looks like me, every woman in her 40s, every woman of whatever color of skin, whatever her background, there's no seat on the table, she pulls a seat and sits down. This is what drove me. This is the greatest fire. And that fire still burns in me. I will not die till this, that every woman knows she's amazing, she's precious, she's valuable, her dreams matter. No one walks on your dreams. No one crushes your spirit. And absolutely believe this, because if you don't believe in yourself, why will anyone else believe in you? The first storm that hits you will wipe you out. And that's not okay. And yeah, that's what I'm trying to do.
Well, Asma, I think you've done it.
Yeah, but there's still so much left to do, you know. And this is why I'm grateful that I have an opportunity to speak with you, because through this, my accented voice and my story will go to an audience that I may not have been able to connect to.
Mm.
So thank you for the opportunity.
Mm-hmm. I'm so happy that you're here. So wrong that this is so often the way, but it is often the case that it takes something like that happening to give you the fire and the impetus to really make the change. Yeah.
The problem is that sometimes it can be so painful and you can be so isolated that you can't pick yourself up.
Yep. We're going to pause there and talk about the fourth desert island dish. What is your favorite sandwich?
Keema. Keema is mince. We have it in my restaurant. It's a keema toasty. I love mince. And in fact, the aloo chop that I mentioned in the beginning was also that, you know, it's a mince inside. Just my favorite thing. So keema toasty with ketchup. You dip it in ketchup. And our toasties, when I was growing up in India, was like this flying saucer thing. Mm. And they would put it over coal. So then it used to have that smokiness. It was so good.
I love also how prominent ketchup is in your life.
Yes.
Ketchup's important.
Yeah. Because that was the only game in town. India that I was growing up, you didn't have all these different kinds of things. Now, of course, everyone has all kinds of fancy hot sauces and you know, people know what pesto is. And I mean, I never heard of all these things when I was growing up. So the only thing you had was ketchup.
Yeah. What was the weirdest thing when you came over to England after you got married? Like, what did you think of the food? Was there anything that you were really shocked by that you still haven't been able to get on board with?
Lots of things. But the first thing that shocked me was the first time I saw a freezer. This was in the college kitchen. The bursar of the college, where my husband was a don, was taking me around to show me as the new bride. And I thought that that freezer, only thing I've seen that is in horror movies, dead bodies outside there. My God, this is... But at least I didn't ask the bursar. I came back and the first thing my husband asked me is, I hope you didn't ask the bursar that. Is there a dead body in there? I said, no. I was terrified that he opened and there'd be actually a body in there. But lots of things surprised me. But first I want to talk about the shock with Indian food. First of all, I heard the word curry, which I never heard in my life before in India. All our dishes have a name.
Names.
So I didn't know everyone had talked about curry and rice. I was thinking, you know, what are they going to eat? What is curry? Then I went to an Indian restaurant. Someone took us out. I almost died. Food was multicolored. It was sweet. It was like awful. So awful. Then college food. The cabbage someone had boiled like a week ago. Definitely had forgotten about it. Everything was so soggy and no salt or pepper.
Tell us how you really feel, Asma.
I was just awful food. And no ketchup on the table. It was just weird, strange food. It's changed a lot. But 30 years ago, it was challenging, to say the least.
One of the incredible things about Darjeeling Express is that your team consists of Asian immigrant women who all had full-time jobs and were never trained professionally. And they worked for you on their days off and then eventually cut back their hours at their other jobs and gave them up. Why was that such an important element to you? Because obviously starting a restaurant is a huge undertaking. To then undertake it in the way that you did is a whole extra element. But why was that so important?
When I was thinking of the restaurant and then I got the lease, almost everybody who I met in hospitality told me I'll fail. Because they asked me, what are you doing with the kitchen? I said it was the women who were doing the supper club. Even women in hospitality told me I'd fail. I was absolutely convinced I would rock it and be successful. And the way that we got the women in into layers is because I didn't know whether I'd succeed. I didn't know run a restaurant before. I didn't even know how many staff I need. When you're an immigrant, your entire wages go home to support sometimes like 20, 30 people, your children, your partner, elderly parents, you know, treatment of, you know, a sick sibling. You're paying for all of this. I didn't want to have this stress that they quit their secure jobs to come into something which, you know, may or may not work.
Mm.
But very quickly, I understood that, you know, this is going to work. And, you know, I've always called them the original Spice Girls.
I love that.
The five, you know, of which two are grandmothers. I brought the Spice Girls back into my kitchen. And the day the last one joined, we all cried and we hugged each other. It was a sense of homecoming for all of us who were not home. That is when we knew that Darjeeling Express was home. This was, and home is not bricks and mortar. Home is an emotion. So even though we've had to move around because of COVID and other things, we were home every time we cooked together. It was never about this house. Whereas you always think of home as a building or as a house, or even if it's a small thing. But for us, home was emotion and home was feeling that you belonged. we belonged in Darjeeling Express.
We have to talk about the Netflix show. You were the first British chef to feature on the famed Chef's Table. What was that whole experience like?
I didn't think too much. I told them that you can't script me. And also I asked them if they would show my team. This was on a call, and I thought I'd been dropped out of the call because no one responded. And they said, you know, we've done 35 chefs before. No one asked to show their team.
Really?
If you look at all the Chef's Table episodes, not a single one showed their team. And since as well. Yeah. And they said, you know, it's a very short episode. But I said, it has to be meaningful to me. And they said, just do it, Asma. Just go with it. Tell your story. And that's what happened.
How amazing.
And there is a kind of affection and closeness that I have with that team. I think that through my story, many of them who love food, who love to tell stories, heard it differently.
Mm.
And it made an impact for them. You know, you are as only as strong as your team.
Mm.
Why are restaurants suffering now? Because they can't find people to hire. I want to speak about solidarity, but I want to speak about the feminine energy in food. Mm. And that was what I said in Netflix.
And was it a big turning point? Like having that kind of exposure, being on a platform like Netflix, was there a big change when the show came out?
Yes. I mean, we are forced to open on a Monday because of the lease at that time. And so we get four or five people for lunch. It came out on the weekend. The next Monday, we had 100 people for lunch.
Wow.
And it's a 50-seater restaurant. We had 200 people every day. So that's just about what happened to us.
Wow.
That we came out of that alive and didn't drown because nothing prepared me.
I always think when you participate in a life-changing thing like this show, are you aware that it is this big pivotal moment in your career and life?
And I had Gagan, who was also featured, who called me. Gagan is from Calcutta. He's a drama queen. Called me and was telling me, oh, you're going to be in big trouble. You better organize yourself. I was thinking, oh my God, I know these people. He's from Calcutta. He's just doing drama. Oh, it's going to be fine. The people at Chef's Table told me, Asma, get prepared, get ready. It's going to be a thing. Whatever people told you, nothing prepares you for the kind of crazy, I mean, just the passion of people who were coming, the excitement. It surprised me, absolutely. I did think we may get a bit busy, but I didn't know for how long that it would be, you know, sustained right up to COVID when everything ended. And also, I mean, I didn't tell my mother. I talked about the second daughter and that my mother cried. I never told her. I just spoke about it. She saw it first on TV.
Oh, really?
Because I thought this is a chance for me to bare my heart and not to fake it and not to present a person who is so intact and so complete and very confident. Because I need people to know that I'm scarred. I had a lot of trauma, but I've overcome it. I thought that maybe people will be inspired by seeing this to understand that, you know, life goes on.
Mm.
And you are the captain of your ship. No one gets on your ship and tells you where to go. You control your destiny.
And I think so important to be able to say that, which is very hard to do, but without thinking about how you saying that might impact your mother's feelings, because you have to separate those two things.
Yeah, and I had to separate it, and she was fine with it. She was fine with it. And I knew she would. I think that it was really important that I stayed true to who I am.
Mm.
And I think that probably is what everybody picks up from that episode. It's watched a lot by people everywhere, but a lot by women.
It's an amazing episode. If anyone hasn't seen it yet, they must immediately. We're on to the fifth desert island dish. What's the dish you eat the most often?
I eat rice and dal, which is yellow dal, with a spoon of ghee. I eat this a lot because, you know, it's a complete meal for me. I eat this a lot in the restaurant. You know, the whole kitchen and my clothes and my hair and everything. I mean, everything is smelling off the food. I really don't want to eat food, but I'm hungry. So instead of eating kind of junk, I eat rice and dal and ghee. This is the most beautiful combination.
Yeah, it's so good.
Yeah.
Do you still feel like cooking when you get home at the end of a long day?
No.
Does your husband cook?
Oh my God, no.
No.
My son is now cooking for me. But when I go home...
Sorry, I love... Oh my God, no.
And when I go home, I have... The greatest thing in this country is toast and butter. Salted butter.
We do that very well.
Yes, salted butter and marmalade. And I have toast and sometimes I have cereal from the box. I'm amazed when I hear that chefs go home and cook. Oh my God, I don't want to go near a cooker.
No.
No, I just want to sit. And oh, I drink tea. I have tea and I have toast. And now my son makes toast and jam. And sometimes he's quite sweet. He tries to make me something extra. But I keep telling him, don't bother. Just give me toast. Give me toast and butter so much that the butter is trickling down from the edges.
Yes. Yeah. Or leaves bite marks.
Yes. Yeah. So that you have to butter it that much.
Yeah.
And none of this kind of unsalted butter junk.
No.
Salted butter. Yeah.
I'm not really sure how you've done it, but in amongst everything that you've done, you've written 3 books, the third of which, Monsoon, is out now. This book really focuses on teaching how to use Indian spices confidently. Do you think people in this country are still a bit scared of how to do that?
Yes. And I think that this is also our fault.
Mm.
Because when you go to restaurants, the menus are huge. Everything is drowned in butter and cream. You know, people probably think we bathe in ghee and cream in India. It's a hot country. Everything splits, you know, especially in Calcutta. You can't add... butter. Only place where they have butter and cream and paneer is in Punjab. It's cold. Mm. They have winter. We don't even have winter. You have 2 days in winter in Bengal. The misconception and the amount of tomatoes that everything is put in. Mm. Tomatoes only, we get it for a few weeks in winter in most places. It's a winter vegetable. So I think that I just wanted to, both my books, the earlier ones, you know, really kind of was about home recipes. Also because I learned to cook in this country. I came back and replicated. So it seems to be kind of everyday simple food. But Monsoon is a book that was always in me. Here is about the joy of eating, of being grateful. There are recipes in there for you to use up like 5 things that are in your fridge.
Mm.
Straggly bits of this and bits and that. You easy things that are inexpensive, but transforming it. Transforming potatoes to be like crusted with poppy seeds. Really using... everyday food, but adding a bit of spice. And this is not a long list of ingredients. I'm always upset because you see people who've written cookbooks on Mediterranean food and other food, and they have pages of ingredients. Mm. Somehow people think Indian food has got, you need to have a larder full of spices. Absolutely not. We come from a hot country. Food has to be made efficiently. Spices are minimal. And what I do in the first few pages of the book is tell you how to get the most out of spices. Mm. Less is always more. It's about layering it. It's the joy of actually having flavors in there. You know, so the book is divided into 6 seasons, but also 6 flavors of Ayurveda. The perfect meal is one that stimulates, you know, more than 3 or 4 of those flavors. Sweet, sour, umami, tangy, spicy. Everything works like an orchestra. Each flavor is an instrument. But what you get is the melody. Everything works together. I hope that people are going to love this book because it really is the joy of eating, but that you satisfy your soul. Because in the East, food was medicine first.
Yeah.
So it's also healing and nourishing.
We're on to the 6th desert island dish. What's your go-to dinner party dish?
Biryani. Mm. Biryani. Also, if I don't make biryani, my guests may leave.
Okay.
That is the other thing. But biryani is complicated and difficult to make, but it's a great one-pot dish.
Mm.
You know, that big platter of biryani that you take out?
Yeah.
Rice and meat works very well. It's such a satisfying entire dish, you know. And our biryani has potatoes in it.
Mm.
And the fragrance, the aroma, and beautifully made rice, I think is just an art.
Yeah.
And definitely biryani. Every dinner party, I would make biryani.
Do you serve anything alongside it?
Yeah, so in my... Again, this is a very traditional family thing.
Yeah.
We do raita, we do a chutney. In my mother's family, they have a chili and onion gravy, which is exactly what I serve in the supper clubs in my restaurant. I do all those 3 accompaniments because that's what we have.
Yeah.
And that completes the biryani. So there your layers come in of tangy, of bitterness, of undertones. So those 3 accompaniments balance the, you know, other elements that are there in the biryani. food is always about layering and stuff. And that's what completes the biryani.
Are you a big pudding person?
I am a huge pudding person. I think it's really important. You must always end a meal on a sweet note. Very important.
So what do you serve?
The one that I like making is something called Shahi Tukra, which is bread, at least two-day-old bread, deep-fried in ghee, soaked in a saffron syrup, and then with thickened cream on top with nuts. Yeah, it's called Shahi Tukra.
Oh, wow. Kind of similar, I know very different, but similar. That's made me think immediately of a rum baba, even though it obviously doesn't
But this is the rum baba on steroids.
Yeah. Okay, that sounds amazing. Is there a difference between puddings that you love making and versus ones that you love eating?
Yes, because every corner, street corner in Calcutta, in India, there's a mithai dukan, which is a sweet shop. Those kinds of sweets you don't make at home.
Okay.
It's like going, you know, how many people make baguette and croissant at home?
Yeah.
Go buy it.
Yeah.
So those are really, I love them. I absolutely, absolutely adore the sweets that are in Bengal. The base is all is curd, is cheese. So they're cheese-based, incredible desserts. And things like gulab jamun, you know, which is deep-fried, you know, it's milk. Milk solids is deep-fried, soaked in syrup. Jalebis, which is again deep-fried and then soaked in syrup. But these, you can't really replicate at home. People do make them, but they're not so nice.
But what about British desserts?
I love trifle.
Oh, do you?
Yes. I absolutely love trifle because this is one thing that, you know, the British left, but they left behind some of their puddings. The food, no one has really continued the tradition of the British left because I don't think that it's not to our palate.
Yeah.
But yes, definitely puddings. Bread butter pudding.
Oh, yes.
Absolutely love that. And, you know, and trifle. Absolutely every gathering would have trifle.
Really?
Yeah. And in the mango season, we have mangoes in the trifle.
Ooh.
And you have not lived if you have not eaten mango trifle.
Well, so what would a mango trifle consist of?
So it's a thing. It's a classic thing, you know.
Would it have jelly?
Yeah, it would have jelly. People put fruit kind of jam, thickened jam. But jelly is what everybody loves to put. So it had jelly, it had cake, it would have custard, it had cream on the top. And then above the cake, soak some homemade syrup that you would make, but cubes of sweet mango.
Ooh.
And other fruits, but sometimes it was only mangoes.
That sounds really good.
Yeah, it's very good.
On Desert Island Dishes, we have a cookbook corner. So I'd love to know, what is your most treasured cookbook?
I know the book is now available. If you can get it, buy it. It's called Indian Delights. It was published in 1961 in Durban by a collective of women of Gujarati heritage, Indian heritage. This is that famous book that among all the incredible recipes, there's a recipe to make biryani for 800 people.
Oh my goodness.
So it's really, truly...
an everyday book.
Yes, absolutely. But it's really, truly a magnificent book.
Wow.
From small meals and pickles and breads. You know, we have to cook for large gatherings. Mm. They have these dishes. So I looked at that and I laughed because it said 50 kgs of rice, 200 kgs of mutton or lamb.
Oh my goodness.
I mean, yes, that is a combination. Four times the amount of meat, that's a proper biryani. It's not 2-1, it's 4-1.
Wow.
And it's just a mind-blowing book. It has incredible recipes. It's the best book I have got. I got the 1961 original from my aunt. When I was, you know, mentioned this thing about the times 100. I went home. It's her personal book. And she's still very young, but she came and gave it to me. She doesn't have any children. She said that you are the true inheritor of this book.
Oh.
And take this, cook with it. And I've seen other people with a book, so I know this book, but now I have my own. I have my own of 1961, original one, from my aunt, who also, you know, came from, she didn't live in South Africa, she lived in India, but she comes from the same region that these women went from, Gujarat. And it's almost like, you know, a vintage piece of jewelry.
Mm.
I value it as much as that.
Yeah,
it is available. It's called Indian Delights. Zuleika has edited it. But you'll know, it's a book from Durban, South Africa. It also is a great way to remind ourselves that our food is all connected.
Mm.
We are all connected. So this is a South African cookbook, but it's the best cookbook I own.
Amazing. Well, on to the final seventh desert island dish. I'd love to know, what is the last dish you'd choose to eat before being cast off to the desert island?
I would absolutely have a pulao, because, you know, biryani is for giving other people, but if rice is very important for me. But I would also have a paratha. Mm. This is where I'm giving away my heritage,
yeah,
father and mother. And absolutely, definitely, the only, at least in my family, and I've seen it, where a whole chicken is cooked, it's a mulk musallam. It's cooked with saffron and spices, and an entire chicken is cooked, there's egg inside it as well. It's stuffed. So it's our, you know, close to what a roast chicken would look like, but without the skin. In our country, we don't eat chicken skin.
And when you say an egg inside, like how it's...
In the hollow egg.
Cracked in?
Yeah, a boiled egg.
A boiled egg.
A boiled egg is put inside with rice. So murg musallam. And my absolute favorite, which is a lamb dish. I mean, it's made with lamb, but in our part of the world, it's made with goat. But with vinegar in it. The vinegar is made with a berry. It's only made in Calcutta, that kind of way. So it kind of really fruity vinegar and chilies. I love that. It's called sirke ka gosht. I've adapted that recipe for monsoon because it is my favorite. Add at least two different types of potatoes. One with nuts in it and the other one, you know, with lemon. Yeah. So tangy, and the other one is sweeter with nuts and sesame. So those two. And trifle,
yes,
for sure. And two kinds of halwa and chai.
Oh, that sounds amazing.
Yeah. And I would eat all of this in layers. So not all together.
Yeah.
I would eat something with something and then, yeah, so that I'd really get to appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, that sounds incredible. And with that, we're going to send you off to the island. Those are your desert island dishes. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So there we have it, another delicious day of desert island dishes. Don't forget, you can rate, review and subscribe to the podcast wherever you're listening. And it really does make such a difference. It boosts the show in the charts and helps other people to find it, which then in turn means I can keep bringing it to you every week. If you don't already, then come and follow me on Instagram at Desert Island Dishes. And you can also sign up for my newsletter at dinnertonight.substack.com. Thank you very much to Wild Nutrition, our sponsor for this season of Desert Island Dishes. And thank you so much for listening. Bye.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or jeffweilercolumbusautomall.com.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Craftsman Days are here at Lowe's with big savings on the tools you need. Save $100 on the Craftsman V26 Tool Power Tool Combo Kit, now at $199. No matter what the project is, Craftsman's high-quality, high-performance products empower you to build on. Visit Lowe's and check out the full line of Craftsman tools today. Valid through 7/9 while supplies last. Selection varies by location. Maximum initial battery voltage measured without a workload is 20 volts. Nominal voltage is 18.